Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 392. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, substitute teacher James Jones.
Best teacher.
the class favorite, Mr. Guillaume Veillette.
Indeed, I was a teacher's pet.
And the jester himself. No, not the jester, the dunce. Anyway, I was thinking of the kid with the hat. Mr. John Lindemann.
Johnny, show me some respect. I'm an accomplished gamer with years of experience.
That's true. That's true. What is that reference from? Is that from a gaff post or something?
I think it's someone who posted that on Steam.
Yeah, somebody reposted that on Twitter, but it's hysterical.
I saw that somewhere this week. Yeah. Anyway, yep. It's very good to be back. Thank you, James and John and Guy, for holding it down last week. You guys did an awesome job. I'm glad I got to join for as much as I did. But it always hurts to miss the show, and I'm very glad to be back. In the meantime, I did go on, because it was on a completely different day of the week, but I did get to record with Player One Podcast, and that was so much fun, and I really appreciate those guys inviting me on. Hopefully, I get to do it again sometime, and we'll get them on this show sooner or later. But it was really fun, and I hope people get a chance to listen to that.
So they didn't say it on the show, but did something happen to Mike halfway through?
Yeah, it was edited a little bit funny, but yeah, Mike just crapped out his internet, and so he wasn't able to come back. Apparently this happens a lot.
Because I've seen some accusations on Neil Gaff that maybe like he was disgusted by all the Nintendo talk. I'm out of here.
No, Mike was really nice. He was joining in. He was participating and all that stuff. So, he just was not able to rejoin, unfortunately. So, anyway, it was super fun. Very casual, friendly. It was just really easy to jump into that and just talk with those guys, you know, because they're so friendly and it was a fun atmosphere. So, good show. Anyway, we got this show to do. So we're going to be talking about some summer gaming, a little mini feature coming up later in the show. And depending on how long that takes, we might get some emails too. But first up is new business. I'll go first since I wasn't on the show for this segment last week. I have been playing, thanks to Club Nintendo's gold reward status, I've been playing Donkey Kong 3 on my 3DS.
Oh, lucky you.
I know. It's been a big time the past week. Donkey Kong 3 is really an arcade game. You know, I think, you know, much like the original and Donkey Kong Jr., it's really devised around like very short play experiences, get as far as you can before you die and try to get a high score. It's not much of as a console game or as a handheld game, it's like, it feels like a mini game, really. There's a couple of different levels. They don't play drastically differently from each other. But it's also a weird game in that it doesn't play anything like the first two Donkey Kongs. I guess you could argue that, I mean, it's probably a nice characteristic of that series that the first three games are all very different from each other. But Donkey Kong 3, I would say, is the least interesting of the three. Because the first two games, at least, have you trying to get from one place to another. I mean, they are platformers. They're very crude, early platformers, and the controls aren't nearly as good as like Super Mario Brothers that came a couple years later. But they're games where you move a character and you're trying to get somewhere, and there's obstacles in the way. I mean, there's something satisfying about that progression. It always feels like you're moving forward, and it feels like the levels are the game. You know, like you're playing through the level. And in Donkey Kong 3, it's more like a shoot 'em up kind of a vertical. Phil Theobald on Player One referred to it as like a Galaga remake or Galaga inspired. And I'd never thought about it that way, but I thought that was really a clever description because it is very similar. You're just playing this guy Stanley with bug spray. You can only shoot it straight up. You can only move left and right and jump. And you've got these bugs coming down. You've also got Donkey Kong hanging right in the middle of the screen. You have to spray him with your bug spray to push him up the rope.
Well, it's funny to hear, you know, the Galaga comparison because, I mean, Donkey Kong was an attempt to replace Radar Scope, which was a, you know, not Galaga clone, but a Space Invaders clone. Like they were getting away from that because those kind of shooter games were a little bit passé in North America. Yeah. So when they brought Radar Scope here, which was a decent success in Japan, it just didn't really catch on over here. So they had to scramble and find a new use for these unused arcade cabinets.
Well, I have to admit, I've never really looked into Radar Scope. I know the name from Nintendo lore, but I've never really played it or taken a look at it. But I always thought it was a remake or kind of a ripoff of Missile Command.
No. You're a small spaceship at the bottom of the screen, and you shoot at the ships coming from the top of the screen. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Okay. Well, yeah. I mean, of course, that kind of game did sort of come back later in the 80s. I think, Galaga was about, 82, 83, but then Gap Plus, I think, was soon after that. There were several. They did become more of a console thing later on, you know, with stuff like Gradius and Life Force, Salamander. Those were, I think there were arcade versions at least of maybe the first Gradius, but I think that became a console series very, very quickly. Anyway, Donkey Kong 3 just isn't as good as any of the games we just mentioned. It's not. It's probably one of the worst Nintendo games. I mean, it's fun, but it's really simple. A lot of times when you die, it feels kind of arbitrary because the enemies move in completely random patterns, and you have to get up. Like, it's an interesting idea that you have to push Donkey Kong up to the top of the level with your spray, because in order to do that, you have to get right up underneath him and like be jumping and shooting just to get it to reach him once he gets towards the top. And it's really hard to do when you've got enemies coming at you from all these different sides. But that's really the only interesting thing in the game. I mean, otherwise, it's really pretty frustrating because the enemies move very randomly. Your character doesn't have... I guess you're pretty mobile, but your attacks are pathetic. You can only attack from underneath, pointing upward. And as you've got enemies coming in from the sides, in the later levels, they'll just surround you. And it's like, it's really, really hard to get away from them. And it doesn't really feel very fair. It feels like you're really outmatched. And they're asking you to do a pretty absurd thing to beat the level by like staying up there and like spraying him nonstop. I've played a lot of levels in it that I feel like you could almost only beat by getting the power up. And so sometimes there'll be a little can of like super bug spray that's up near the top of the level, and you have to push Donkey Kong up high enough to knock that down and grab it. And that thing makes the rest of the level super easy. Like, it's a crazy overpowered power up, but it doesn't appear on every level. And, you know, you're going to get it anyway because it's on the way to beating the level as Donkey Kong climbs up these ropes. So it doesn't even feel like you have to, it's not like you have to risk something to go out of the way to get it or do something especially skillful in order to earn this reward that will then, make the rest of the level easier or something. It's all very weird. It just doesn't seem especially well thought out. I mean, it looks good. I think it's kind of a cute game, and the Donkey Kong sprite looks really good. It looks a lot better than it did in the previous two games. Right. But, there's not much going on here, you know? Like, the screen doesn't even scroll. It's just a really basic thing.
It strikes me as the milking of the franchise. You know, you saw a lot of arcade games do this, you know, in that time period when you were just kind of like, come on, guys. Did you really have to make a third game in this series? Like,
yeah.
And
did we need
third
baby
game
between, Pac-Man?
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Pac-Man, I was just going to come out of my mouth. Pac-Man was the worst for that. Super Pac-Man, Baby Pac-Man. I mean, it just got ridiculous. Pac-World, I mean, all these crap that they came out with, just milking franchises, so it doesn't surprise me that this
is
an early example.
Yeah, well, and it came out so late after the other two, right? Because I think that this came out after Nintendo kind of won the lawsuit that pit them against... who had the license for King Kong back then?
It would have been Universal Studios, I think.
Universal Studios?
Yeah, well, RKO, yeah, maybe.
So. Right.
Maybe. I can't remember who exactly had that.
But. Anyway, that was like Howard Lincoln in a federal district court or something arguing for Nintendo. And they won, and they established public domain over that movie.
Yeah.
Which I think previously had not been done.
Yeah, but it had been so long since Donkey Kong had been a hit. I kind of wonder why they bothered.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I don't know. This feels like it was maybe a different game that they slapped the Donkey Kong brand onto or something. I mean, it just doesn't even thematically make any sense for you to be using bug spray. You know, Mario doesn't appear in the game at all. There's not even a princess. Donkey Kong is just, he's hanging out on these ropes, and it doesn't even make sense that he's not bothering anybody. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no motive. Like, I'm not Chris Kohler. I'm not going to write a book about the story of the first Donkey Kong, but it does have like a basic character motivation, you know, like you're trying to rescue this girl. And in Donkey Kong Jr. has the same thing. You're trying to rescue your father. So Donkey Kong 3 just feels like you're this asshole with the bug spray and you're, you know, just annoying this animal that's not hurting anybody. Yep. It's really crazy.
Well, come on. He's all up in your greenhouse. So
is that it? He's invading your greenhouse for some reason? Maybe you're growing bananas. Ideas.
This is my obligation to the civilization of the world.
Anyway, so thanks, Nintendo, for the free video game. I appreciate that, but it's not a good one. And if you're a Club Nintendo member and you got one of these awards, if there's anything else that you don't already have, I would probably take that over Donkey Kong 3. Like even a copy of Super Mario Brothers on a system where you don't already have it is probably, you'll probably get more enjoyment out of that than you will from Donkey Kong 3.
This definitely knocks that off the potential list. Not that it was high to begin with, but definitely it puts a stake in it.
I played it a couple times when I was a kid. You know, I would occasionally see it in an arcade, and I'd want to go play it out of curiosity because I was like, wait, there's another Donkey Kong? And I'd always come away like, well, that was a lot different, you know, but like I never really liked it that much. And the past few days have been by far the most I've ever played it, and there's really not much there.
Yeah. I want to know how James feels about the numbering of the series.
You gonna open that can?
I don't give a shit because they didn't start at 7.
Oh, okay.
Well, also, they started at 3. Wrong. Technically speaking, this was the third arcade Mario game, Donkey Kong
but they
game.
still started at 3. It's completely inconsistent.
Okay, that's considerably more defensible.
Donkey Kong 3, a new hope.
The best part is they went from 3 to 94.
Mm.
It's a big jump.
Oh.
Mm.
Yeah, Donkey Kong 94 would be a far better investment than this. And I mean, this game sells for $5 on the 3DS Virtual Console for the same price or maybe even less, probably like $3 or $4 you could get Donkey Kong 94 for Game Boy. And it's a far better, far, far more interesting and challenging game than this.
But it's free if you spent hundreds of dollars on Nintendo games this year.
Yeah. So, I've got one more strange thing to talk about, I guess. I don't need to say much, but I did this is kind of a progress report, I guess, on my backlog. This week I decided, well, I've wanted to do this for a long time, but I finally picked back up Call of Duty Black Ops 2 for the Wii U. There was a moment this week where I thought, you know, I bet in the world at this very moment, I may be the only person playing the campaign for Call of Duty Black Ops 2 on Wii U. But anyway, you know, these games sold terribly, but as you may know, I mean, Black Ops 2 and Ghosts on Wii U were both like really good conversions, and this game still is impressive. I mean, it's a launch title for Wii U, but I think it still looks good. It plays well. It's very smooth. I've been playing a lot on the gamepad, and that works really well. It's kind of like having a handheld Call of Duty game, which they tried on Vita and failed miserably, but this one's actually good. So this one's been on my backlog for a while because I just I never sat down long enough to play the campaign. I've tried a couple times and something always distracts me. It's not that I don't like it, but it really annoys me that I haven't done it just because I know it's probably super short. So, you know, when a game is like 4 hours long and I've only partially completed it, that drives me crazy. So I did lose my progress from the flood incident, so I did have to start all the way over. So far I've only been through the first couple missions, which I've seen before. So I don't have anything new to tell you, but I think even now, almost 2 years after the system was launched, I think this game looks really nice. I think that it's a very impressive version of it. And, you know, it's been quite a while since I messed around with Call of Duty. I'm not an avid fan like John is, but you know, even just playing the campaign, I say, like, these are like impressive action games. Like they've put a lot of thought into you know, planning out these scenes for like maximum craziness. The voice acting is very earnest and over the top and crazy. And, you know, I think they do, they probably don't get enough credit for, you know, how the lengths. I mean, I feel like they really are eager to show people that, that this series can compete with Hollywood movies. It may be competing with stuff like The Expendables 2. Like, it's probably about that level of intelligence and wackiness, but I mean, I think it's up there. You know, it's a spectacle, and I think video gaming needs spectacles on the scale, at least. I don't know that Call of Duty is really the best representation of what video games can be as an art form, but they're you know, it's kind of like the Michael Bay syndrome. It's like, you know, I don't need to go see Michael Bay movies, but I'm glad someone is like really pushing the technical limits of that stuff, because eventually all that will filter down into other things that I like more. And I think mm-hmm. that's happened with Call of Duty a lot.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm glad they spend really a lot of money to be on anything it. It's not. I mean, it's just you know, it's just
that's
you go
actually
in there.
Not true after the Snoop Dogg voice back.
I got the Snoop Dogg voice back, by the way.
Of course you fucking did.
It's hilarious. It is exactly what you think it is. Hilarious, but at the same time cringeworthy.
Yeah, so stupid.
They let Snoop be Snoop.
I mean, God bless Snoop. He's making more money. Good for him. But, I mean, Black Ops 2, it's a good game. I mean, I really liked what they did with the campaign, with the strike missions, the ones where you have the overview of the battlefield and you can kind of zoom down to first person and determine where stuff goes. Those are actually really, really cool. Like, that's one of the coolest things I've seen in a first-person shooter in a long time. Like, it's actually innovative. I mean,
yeah, they're real-time strategy stages in Call of Duty. Like,
yeah.
It may not be the best thing that series has ever tried, and it may not be the best version of that kind of game, but the fact that they did that in Call of Duty, I love. I love that they're willing to be that experimental and do something that you can imagine a lot of their fans probably won't like, or at least they've never played before. Maybe they've tried these kinds of games before and they didn't work out for them. And, you know, I mean, the blending up real-time strategy with first-person shooter, especially when it's the first-person shooter, is very admirable, I think. And I hope that they bring stuff like that back in Advanced Warfare. Like that playing the first future stage in Black Ops 2 last night, it made me think, you know, I would love for Call of Duty Advanced Warfare, the one that's coming out this year, I'd love for that to be really good. I'd love for that to be the best Call of Duty yet.
Because it looks good.
Yeah, and to me, like, Modern Warfare was, you know, had some kind of interesting things in it in terms of the equipment that you used and the kinds of weird missions they did, because they were always, they call them modern, but it was always like slightly futuristic.
Yeah.
And for me, it always was kind of a tease. I was like, I just want you to take it all the way. You know, if we're going to be running around shooting realistic looking people, I would appreciate an extra layer of fantasy on that, because some of the stuff they do in Black Ops 2 and Modern Warfare is so grisly, and it all is like, you know, they're messing with some like political ideas that they don't maybe fully understand, or at least they don't really give it probably the respect that it deserves. And even just the way they depict the violence in these games is all just a bit much for me in the more realistic settings. I mean, the first level in the past of Black Ops 2, and you're in Vietnam. It's not Vietnam. It's
It's in Cuba.
No, it's one of the African countries. I can't remember which one now, because they never tell you like very much context at all.
Oh
for
yeah,
these
because
missions.
They're not gonna say here's a level where you shoot the fuck up out of Zaire.
Yeah. I
mean, they're not going to say
Well, they do get pretty specific sometimes with locations and time periods, but it's just my point is the presentation of the games is that they want you to be kind of confused and overwhelmed all the time. And so they don't give you a whole lot of backstory before you jump into a level. They don't necessarily tell you everything about where you're going, what you're going to be doing. They want you to like figure it out as you go along. But anyway, the game starts out with you like, you're like your character's inches away from a dude who's inside of a glass box burning to death, and you watch his face as the fire consumes him and as he realizes that he's not going to escape the situation. And I was like, what the hell are they doing starting a video game out like this? And
hey, it's drama, buddy. You want drama? You got drama.
It's not right? drama. It's just soft. Exploitation. Right. I mean, you don't know who that guy is. You don't know why you're in this situation. You can't do anything about it. It's manipulative for no reason other than just to make you like feel like, wow, this game's serious.
Well, I mean,
this is war, man. War has changed, Johnny.
That started back with the original Modern Warfare, where at the very beginning you see them execute a dude, and then and then they set off a nuke. I mean, it was totally unnecessary stuff.
Well, this is completely different, though, because in that game, and I like that game, and I like the story in that game, the second one totally lost me. But in the first Modern Warfare, I like the story because the scene where the guy gets executed, there's like a 5-10 minute buildup before that point where you're playing as that character and you're hearing all the stuff around him and you see where he is and what he's going through and you start to figure out why he's there. And then they execute him. And yes, it's still manipulative and it's still done a lot for shock value, but he is an important character in that story. And they spend plenty of time establishing who he is and why this is happening to him. But when you burn a man alive who you never find out who he is, you don't even know where you are when this is happening or what's going on. It's just people yelling and gun and like bullets whizzing overhead. And you're looking at this guy and his skin is peeling off. And it's like, really? That's the very first thing you see in the game is once you start playing it. I didn't care for that. And I hope stuff like Advanced Warfare is far enough removed from reality that they don't feel the need to try to impress that kind of thing on you. I mean, maybe they'll take it as license to be more extreme, but what I'm hoping is that it sort of, you know, it lets them tell whatever story they want without having to go so over the top with, like, I don't know. I don't know what the intent is behind stuff like this, but it just really stuck out to me. I couldn't have even told you that happened from the first time I played. Either I wasn't paying attention or, you know, I was looking for other things at that time, but this time I was like, wow, this is really extreme.
Yeah,
seems unnecessary.
The thing is, yeah, I mean the fact is that the stories they tell aren't very complex, so they don't need to they just don't need to do it to tell their story. They aren't doing that to layer anything onto their story or make their or add depth to their character's experience. It's just gratuitous. So yeah. I mean, I don't even remember that, but I'm block out. I pretty much dump most COD stories as soon as they're over, so
yeah, they're I guess you might say pulpy. They're just really over the top, and you know, you're right. They are simple stories. I mean, I think the games try to gussy them up a lot with detail and gore, mm-hmm. and you know, all these surprising, shocking moments of violence or of you know, betrayal or whatever. But they're really not that complicated.
Well, I mean, really, and to that same extent, the stuff you talked about earlier, they things like set pieces blowing up. I mean, mm-hmm. that really is, I don't want to say it is diminishing of the story, but it is certainly a way that they create interest as opposed to having complex plot.
Like, yeah, I mean, they use that the way a horror movie uses jump scares.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, was it the second Modern Warfare game where you went through, I can't remember what U.S. city it was, and they just blew the fuck up out of it? Like, the whole...
That was D.C. I think that was Washington, D.C. You're going through all these residential neighborhoods.
If that was D.C., that's the worst D.C. I've ever seen. That's like that's like Space Lincoln bad D.C. Oh, my God.
Well, I think it was the suburbs, but yeah.
Yeah, it's still really
bad. You go from
the
suburbs to the White House, and you have to, like, dig out the vice president or something out of the White House.
Oh, my God.
It's no conduit, I'll tell you that.
You know what?
Very similar storylines in some ways. All right, well, let's move on to what Mr. Vayette has been playing.
Yeah, well, going back to arcade games, Nintendo released recently Mr. Driller 2 on the GBA Wii U VC. That's a lot of acronyms. So I jumped on that. I had never played... Yeah, I had never really played a Mr. Driller game, and I don't know. I didn't do any research. I was kind of desperate to find something new to talk about for this podcast. So I was like, yeah, sure, Mr. Driller 2. It's probably better than 1 and probably, you know, full featured and everything.
Nope.
But it turns out I was wrong.
Yep.
The game itself, if you're like me and you had never played a Mr. Driller game, is pretty simple. You're constantly going down these tunnels that are about, I don't know, like 8 blocks wide. And you've got these various shapes of various colors. And you're kind of digging through them. And if you dig through one part of a block, which can be of basically any size, like it kind of looks like a puzzle game. It kind of reminds you of Tetris, but the blocks can be like, they're not limited to just, you know, four, they're not tetraminos. Like they're not, they can be absolutely huge, or they can be just like 1x1 blocks. So if you drill one color, basically the whole thing disappears, the whole block. And so the challenge is trying to dig your way through to the next air capsule, because your air supply is going down continually and at a very fast pace. And you're drilling down and you're trying to not have the ceiling crush you. But the graphics are super colorful. Mr. Driller himself, like, this is a Namco game, so he kind of looks like a mix of Astro Boy and Pac-Man. His eyes are just huge. His pupils are just huge, I guess. Maybe to better see in the dark. In a way, it's a very realistic game. I don't know. It's very colorful, but at the same time, super stressful and really, really difficult. Because every time that you drill something, there's always the chance that the blocks that you didn't drill before, that are over your head, are going to just fall on you and crush you. Like, they don't disappear as soon as they leave the screen. Everything that you've seen can come back and just crush you.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so it's really fast paced, and it looks like a puzzle game, but I never really have time to just sit down and kind of puzzle my way through it. Like, there's never any time to think. You have to constantly drill. Every time I've tried to kind of plan my moves ahead of time, I've died quickly.
I remember it being very fast-paced from the very little I played. I don't even remember what version that was. It might have been PS1?
Let me tell you, according to my review of Mr. Driller 2 posted on May 15th, 2005, I said, I quote, "It can't seem to decide if it wants to be an action game or a puzzle game." Think about that.
I'd rather not.
Marinate on that for a minute.
No.
Like, to be honest, I think this is very clearly an action game. I mean, it might look like a puzzle game, but just no. I'll get to maybe some certain puzzle elements later. But in Mr. Driller 2, there's an endless mode. Just like puzzle games. Okay, maybe you got a point. And you do have kind of a time attack mode where you are trying to beat a set time, and you go through these discrete levels, and you're kind of going from like time bonus to time bonus, and try to make it to the end of the level in time. But there's only like about 10 of those levels. And then, from what I've read on Wikipedia, because I haven't been good enough to unlock them all, then you unlock reverse courses. And, you've also got a mission mode where there's 3 countries, I think India, the US, and, I didn't even look at the hard one. And so you've got these levels that you have to go through different depths. And even the India one, which is the beginner level and which is kind of the shortest distance that you have to cover, very, very difficult. It took me an evening to get through it. And I haven't been able to beat the US level. So, I don't know. Like, it kind of feels in Mr. Driller 2 that there's a lack of modes, a lack of levels, and there's 2 playable characters. I think there's supposed to be subtle differences between them, but I just...
Is it Ms. Driller?
No, it's the main character is called Susumu, and the girl is Anna, and she's his German rival. So there you go.
Everybody has one.
Yep. Yep. Wilhelm is my I hate that guy. But anyway. So there's a dearth of modes, and I just like you're kind of thrown into the game, and there's not a whole lot of explanation as to what you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to solve quote unquote these levels. You're kind of just expected to already know how to play the game, and it's really not newcomer friendly. And I was looking up online, are there strategies for this game? Like, are there things that I should be looking out for? Just general strategies, kind of like, I don't know, like when you're learning Picross, you kind of learn, okay, well, when I'm in this situation, this is what works best, or this is how you kind of get around the fact that you don't seem to have all the information that you need to go ahead. So I was looking for just general tips, and I couldn't find anything. But then, as I was doing my research, I also realized that Mr. Driller 2 was a launch GBA game in Japan. So that kind of explains why it looks kind of ugly. And even
and
though, like, it's very
was 2005?
2005.
Yep. It took like 4 years
what
to come
hell?
To North America.
Yeah, it was released in April 2005.
Yep.
Ned, I must say, Namco making a mediocre launch game? That never happens. That's so surprising.
I thought you were going to say it took 4 years for John to review it.
Oh, James. James, you.
No, they just sat on it for 4 years. But yeah, so just a very simple version of the game. And turns out that I was going to have a whole rant about how, like, oh, Namco should really be bringing an updated version of Mr. Driller to the Wii U. Like, now that Nintendo has these decent electronic, you know, like, eShops, why isn't Namco taking advantage of it? But then, as I was doing my research, I realized, oh, they already did. There's a DSiWare game, and there's a WiiWare game, and they're both more full of content and better than Mr. Driller 2.
Yep.
Nice.
So, there's really no reason to get the Wii U, the GBA version on Wii U, because you don't have true portability. You can have way better than just off-screen play if you buy the DSiWare game, and it seems to be the most recent of those three versions, and it seems to be the most full-featured. You've got more playable characters, they've got different characteristics, like Mr. Driller can only jump on blocks of, you know, one height, like one by one blocks. But there's like other characters that can jump like two blocks, and there are others that can survive being crushed once, and there are others, you know, they've got different characteristics, and they make the game a little bit easier, and they've also got, they seem to have more incremental difficulty levels. So I actually downloaded the DSiWare version, and I'm super pleased with it.
Nice. Yeah, and just lest people forget, you can download DSiWare on the 3DS eShop. So
it's not
hoops to jump through. You don't have to use friggin' Wii mode or anything crazy like that.
Exactly.
Just like any other 3DS game, except it's cheaper.
Yeah, and you've got your icon right in your 3DS menu, so it's perfect. And it's the cheapest version of them all.
Yeah.
It's $5, so go for it.
Nice.
And yeah, I just want to come back very quickly on Game & Wario and Tomodachi Life, a game that Tomodachi Life, I've probably put like 60, 70 hours in it.
Holy crap.
I need to stop. I need to find something else. Like, I'm going to find something
Life,
else.
More like it.
I'm going to find something else that's a time sink and super grindy. Like, maybe I'm going to finally take up Rune Factory or something. I don't know, but anything to play something else.
Something to replace the grind.
Yeah, someone on Twitter asked me, like, how can this game still have legs for you? I was bored after 5 hours. It started repeating itself, and, you know,
I was
done.
Yeah, me too.
And
that's how I feel. I mean, I like it, but I play this even less than Animal Crossing.
Right. Well, I really think it's because, you know, the girlfriend was playing it so much, and we kept showing each other, like, oh, this is what's happening in my game, and this is what this guy is doing. It's so stupid in my game, you know. Mm-hmm. And we would feed the game our in-jokes, and then we would kind of take in-jokes back from it. Like, sometimes when we're just, we don't really have anything clever, or, like, when we're saying platitudes to each other, which happens from time to time. We just say it in a very monotone, you know, Tomodachi-esque voice. And this change of scenery is always nice, you know, and things like that. So it's just like we've gotten a lot out of that game, and I'm very pleased to have played it. And also, like, one of the end goals, like, if you, you know, for people at home who need something to work up to, you can get maybe, like, Johnny's Me on your game. And then just give him, I think it's $1,000 or $10,000, and give him a trip to space. That's what I did.
Oh, yeah, do that.
Yeah, so you've walked on Mars. Johnny.
So basically, you're saying get Johnny in your game and then give him money to go away.
Exactly. Well, he comes back. He comes back. He gets to keep the astronaut suit. And you get also pictures of your, you know, walking on Mars and stuff like that. So that's what I did. And that's, you know, let's imagine that that's the end game.
Pixar, it didn't happen. I want to see the screenshots, man.
Yeah, I'll send them to you. And also Game & Wario is another game that I'm getting something out of. You know, a lot of like, what the hell?
Getting something out of it.
Yeah, I'm
arrested.
A lot of what the hell is going on, and a lot of like, this is so weird. But I've noticed that the mini games themselves, I am never all that eager to play them. So I can't recommend
good
the game.
Pitch.
No, seriously, I can't. But then again, like, it's not like I randomly fire up like Wii Party.
Every
you.
Time I turn this game on, I die inside.
Well, it's just, you know, it's minigame syndrome. Like you never really. I don't know. I don't play those by myself, and they're the ones in Game & Wario are kind of mostly single player focused. So it's just very strange. It's a strange collection. But you do unlock continually kind of weird toys and weird knickknacks in a virtual kind of toy shelf, and they're kind of fun to play with, and they kind of remind you that, oh yeah, like the Wii U is a really strange and really unique piece of hardware. For instance, like, it's really stupid, but one of the things you can unlock is a high-tech mirror, and so it's using the camera and the gamepad and to, you know, replicate a mirror. So, you know, it's not really that
alternatively
special.
You could use a mirror.
Sure, but what a mirror can't do is show you the bald spot on your head, which I've thoroughly explored on the TV screen, because that's what makes it a high-tech mirror. I just, you know, you can move it around, and on the TV you can see what the camera is seeing, and I don't know, like, it's just weird, because I've never had a webcam on anything other than a laptop, so any cameras that I've had have had, like, the screen tethered to them. So it was kind of fun to play with that.
Guillaume's making home movies in Wario.
Oh, yeah. So you know. We know what that means. Yeah.
And, yeah, there's weird stuff. Like, you can, I don't know, weird jokes and weird.
So, Guillaume, what do you say? Game & Wario worth your $0?
I think it was worth mine.
Worth your selection from the other options? Among the other options?
I mostly own the other stuff. Yeah. I don't know. If you want more of a game experience, go with NES Remix. And if you've got, you know, if you already mostly own everything else, I would check this out, because the same developer made Game & Wario and Tomodachi Life, and also, you know, classics such as Rhythm Heaven. And I think they might be my favorite Nintendo developer, even though they don't necessarily make my favorite Nintendo games. Because of the goofy stuff. Well, Rhythm Heaven is really, really amazing.
And to be clear, Rhythm Heaven has another outside party involved in its development. So.
Yeah.
Mm.
There's a music studio kind of.
Music slash art slash chaos in generating studio involved.
Sure, but the same wackiness that you find in Rhythm Heaven, you find in, you know, Tomodachi Life and Game & Wario. And yeah, I really appreciate that. You got to appreciate it for what it is. And what it is perhaps not a great game, but it sure is trying to do some interesting stuff with the Wii U and trying to at least make you chuckle. Yeah. And it worked with me.
Okay, good. So let's move on to John for some MMO action.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, one kind of long-term project Johnny and I have had is we've always kind of had it on the bucket list to play Final Fantasy XIV. Well, this weekend they had a free – I didn't resubscribe, but this weekend they had kind of a – if you have a lapsed subscription, come back and you can play for free sort of thing. So, yeah, so I got my fix of that this weekend, and I think – and Johnny actually played for a little bit. I didn't see him online. Well, he wasn't able to get on the right server. So.
It's, dude, that was a disaster trying to get on there. Also, I mean, this was the first time I'd played at all because I was traveling last week. I downloaded the game before I left, but I didn't want to get my free trial going. I didn't want to start using time on my subscription until I got back. So I didn't set up a character or anything like that. Got back and it said, you have 18 days left on your whatever. So I think it started it anyway once I installed the game, basically.
Yeah, because you would have set up your account and everything. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so. I did create an account. I just didn't make a character. So anyway, but
yeah.
At this point, I've played so little, John. I've done like running around town quests, but I haven't even gone outside the city or fought a battle yet. So
yeah,
I don't have a whole lot to say except that, gee, there's a whole lot of crap on the screen. It's a little disorienting. You know, this is my first MMO, so. You know, I've played things that are maybe similar, like Xenoblade and now the Destiny Alpha and Beta. So I have some idea, you know, but it's still it's I don't know how user-friendly it is for people who are really unfamiliar with this kind of game.
It actually is, because they really do a good job of tutorial windowing everything, but not in an annoying way. They do it in a sensible way. Like when there's something comes up, you're like, I don't really know. And I mean, even me, because what they do from other MMOs is they rename a lot of stuff. So a lot of times they'll refer to something, a concept, whatever, and it'll be using a term that I don't know about. So they'll explain it with, you know, it with a tutorial window, and I'll say, oh, okay, that's like X from World of Warcraft or this or that mm-hmm. or the other, mm-hmm. right? So they do a really good job of that. So the one good thing about this one, for somebody who's never played an MMO before, is the fact that it was designed with the console audience in mind, with the console audience not necessarily knowing much about MMOs. So it's really good as like a starter MMO. For me, it's maybe a little bit slow paced, because I can kind of jump right in and you know hit the ground running. Mm-hmm. But it's good. I like the fact almost that it's a little bit more console like, because what you'll find with PC MMOs, they assume that people are playing with keyboards, and so there's a higher level of what they assume you can do with keybinds, with macros, with add-ons that you can install. You know what I mean? There's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, they really almost designed the games. User interfaces.
Yeah. So they've kind of distilled a lot of the stuff down. You know, that you don't like getting your character up to, you know, like you know, the cap. Even when you do that, you don't have an overwhelming amount of skills that you have to manage. Whereas in other MMOs, you'll have like 25, 30 skills that you have to prune accordingly, depending on how well you know your class. I think it's very good. I mean, I think if we sat down and played it, I think what would probably help you would be if you played it by yourself for a little while to just kind of get your feel. You know what I mean? Before you start grouping with people, or I start dragging you around places.
I don't even
right?
know how to navigate right now. Like I can't read the map. I don't know where I am or how to get to anything. All I can do is follow the little arrows that are on the radar when I get a quest.
Yep. So, yeah. So, you know, at some point you should probably just kind of hop in there, you know, and just kind of spend some time with it. It's something, I mean, you know, it's an MMO, so it's meant to be played over a long period of time. So,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
But
I'm not complaining. I had very little time to play it this past weekend with Destiny being out, and I was editing this podcast, and I was getting ready to be on Player One. So I was playing certain things so I could talk about them on there. And you know, and I had just got back from traveling. So it was very hard to find time to play any FF14. But and I regret that I didn't get a chance to play it with you, John. But, you know, once I get a little more established in it, I mean, I bought the game, you know, and I'm going to play it. I'm going to put some time into it. I want to have like a good MMO experience. And even if I don't like it, I can say, well, I know why I don't like it. You know, I suspect that I will like it. And I think this will be a good entry point, just because I've played all the other main Final Fantasy games except 11. So, you know, I know the universe, I know a lot of the terminology that they're using for, at least for characters and classes and things like that, you know, items and magic. Like, I understand that stuff innately. It's just that, you know, if you're like me and you don't play MMOs, but you have played a lot of RPGs and you have played a lot of Final Fantasy, this may be one of the best bridges you'll find, but I'll still say it's pretty different. And it's pretty overwhelming when you first log into it. Just, you know, it's funny. You say that it's designed more for a console experience, and I'm sure that's true. But like, it's still very. It looks like a PC game to me. You know, it could be a lot
it's
worse.
MMO.
But
yeah.
I mean, there's a little status window in the corner that's like typing out like, you know, little messages about everything that's going on. Every time I accept the quest, it prints out a little message that says, you accepted this quest. And that thing's up all the time. So that's just like part of the game. And I assume when you chat with people that it goes there. there's just a whole bunch of stuff on the screen that makes no sense to me at all. And the text is all really tiny. So like if I tried to play some while I was eating dinner the other night, but I had to eat at the table because I was eating something messy. I didn't want to try to eat it on the couch. And even just at a little bit of an angle and sitting slightly farther away than I normally do from the TV, I couldn't even read the text anymore. And I eventually had to do something else until I finished eating. So, you know, the game works well on the – I'm playing on PS4, and the game, it feels like it controls fine. I haven't gotten into combat yet, so I probably am not qualified to say. But it makes sense. You know, I think they make smart use of the touchpad on the PS4. Not a whole lot of games have really done much with it. But I think it's perfect for this game because it gives you, like, a very limited kind of mouse-like interface if you need it for certain things. And again, yeah, like this, it's easy to imagine that would come in handy.
Yeah, I mean, I've played it on PS3 and I've played it on PC. I prefer PC just because obviously the controls are they're a lot better. They are. They're better than the console controls, but the console controls are actually really well done. It's just that, you know, I'm used to playing MMOs on a PC. I have like a gamepad for it and everything like that. I'm very set up for MMOs on PC, so that's what I prefer. Mm-hmm. But I enjoy playing
on a
PS3.
Gamepad with keyboard, like as a supplement.
Yeah.
Can
it's,
you do that?
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I don't think you can because they wouldn't have drivers for PS4. I use the, Logitech, whatever it is, G13. So, but it's just a little like mini keyboard kind of thing that's set up with a joystick and everything. So it's really convenient for MMOs. That's what it's made for.
Oh, so you're using a joystick to control the character though.
Correct. Yeah. 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 So, but
you also have all these buttons, huh?
Yep. Yep. But I mean, what you do, I mean, it's a joystick that you map to the keyboard controls, right? So it just makes it easier. So it's a pretty cool setup, but they wouldn't have drivers for PS4 for that. So, but said, you know, the keyboard controls are really well done. I mean, the console controls, the gamepad controls, and you can actually use the gamepad with the PC version as well. What you'll find is that you'll wind up, you know, tweaking shortcuts and finding out what you use more than other things. And you kind of put those on hotkeys that you can, you know, perform certain gamepad combos. You have to figure that out though. Like you have to actually put some time
into it.
Yeah,
right now I don't even understand enough to know why you would want to do any of the stuff you just said, but I'm sure it's important. Yeah, this is a deep hole that I'm diving into, and it's a little bit scary for me. I mean, I know tons of people play MMOs, and it shouldn't seem like a big deal, but so far it looks and feels a lot different than anything I've done before with RPGs, and so it's a little intimidating for me, I have to admit, but I am excited to get more into it, and once I get a little more established and know what I'm doing, John, will you resubscribe at least for a month and
maybe
we can play together?
That'd be awesome. But you know what's interesting is when I was playing it, I realized that a lot of the problems with MMOs is that you don't get tutorials, right? A lot of the way you learn these games is by going to websites and community blogs and stuff like that,
or
right?
Or they give you really really boring basic quests, like I need you to go to this town with item.
Yeah, I mean the thing is, it's like okay, so the bulk of these games is like you know doing like five man, you know, stuff like that and doing raids and stuff like that, but nowhere in any of these games is any of that ever explained, and like combat is barely explained, right? Which is like complete core of the games, which just kills me, right? So this is why you're forced to kind of do research for anything, right? Which I think turns a lot of people off. That's understandable.
So,
completely understandable.
So is the gameplay, like, does it remind you of other Final Fantasy games, solo Final Fantasy games, or like does the story have a lot of Final Fantasy elements to it?
The story definitely does.
Oh yeah,
the get go, the story is very Final Fantasy. I mean, gameplay wise, I can't even tell you yet.
Gameplay wise, it's straight World of Warcraft, but that's not a bad thing. I mean, that's good because you know what they've done is they've taken what works in World of Warcraft and just cloned it and put all of the Final Fantasy stuff over it. But that's okay because I've seen other MMOs that try to rip off World of Warcraft and they don't even match it feature for feature. So it's like if you're going to rip off World of Warcraft, at least put everything that's in World of Warcraft in the game, and they've done that, which is cool.
Wouldn't you rather
which is why
see,
I like it.
Wouldn't
no.
you rather see something in the genre do something that's
no.
not World
nope.
of Warcraft?
Nope.
Why?
If it's not broke, don't fix it because then it becomes a different genre.
Well,
and then it becomes Star Wars The Old Republic, and Star Wars The Old Republic is a game that never should have been
MMO. Star Wars The Old Republic is bad because EA and the related accoutrement that made it are also bad. That's why that game is bad.
Accoutrement?
No, it's bad because they took what should have been a single-player game and they made it into an MMO.
Well, yeah, that's ultimately the root of them being bad. Like, they did they did evil and made that game bad.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. We don't have to moralize on Electronic Arts here, but
yeah, I mean, definitely we can give it a try, man. I think you'd enjoy it. Cool. Once you kind of make it through the first sort of tutorial thing and just kind of get your bearings, I think you would. I think you'd dig it. Actually, wanted to say, bringing it back to something Nintendo related, talking about the tutorials that are horrible in this genre. What's the best MMO tutorial I've seen? Xenoblade. That is a fantastic. Really? Yeah, that game is an MMO. It's just you play it single player. It's an MMO. It has aggro, all of that shit that they explain to you beautifully in every pop-up.
It's an MMO without the douchebags, basically.
Basically, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean,
well, and
that's Jay's opinion, but
you know, I guess we don't know for sure, but it looks like the sequel on Wii U will be online. So maybe that'll be even more like a real MMO.
Yeah, I mean,
or at least an SMO, like a small multiplayer online.
They'll probably have like instant stuff or something like that.
In that case, you're kind of talking about something like a Phantasy Star layout where there are
or Destiny
online with you at the moment, but
right, right. Yeah, I mean, you could play together, but it's not like a giant. I'll say, FF14 is really pretty so far from what I've seen. I like the look of it, and that was one of the big drivers to make me want to try this one, whereas I have not tried. A lot of MMOs are pretty ugly, so the fact that they made a really pretty one is enticing, and play Final Fantasy on my PS4. Like, that's kind of exciting. It'd probably be quite a long time before I get to do that again with 15. And, so far I'm still stuck in the town and the first city that I came to, but I'm excited to get outside and like see the world. And, I think you guys could probably guess from my comments on other games, but the reason I am interested in playing this game is I really want to explore the world. I want to see the different places they've put together. I guess the combat I'll probably put up with, kind of like I did in Xenoblade. I never loved the combat, but it was okay. Yeah. And it got me through the stuff I did want to see. So I'm looking forward to getting out there. But
yeah, definitely try to roll on my server when you have a chance, because I can pull you through a bunch of content, right?
Yeah, I'll try. I mean, I guess I could either start a new character for free, or I could pay a fee for some reason to move my character to your server.
Don't do that. That's just dumb. For level
I don't
one
understand
character,
why
stupid.
They would charge a fee for that. It's
because they don't
so
want people
ridiculous.
Congregating on one server. They basically is like, well, your server sucks. You could pay us to get on a better one. Or you could stick to this kind of sucky one.
Yeah, they can. It's kind of common practice.
That seems like fleecing to me. That seems very anti-consumer.
Well, that's basically what every MMO does at this point, so yeah.
Yeah. I know it's common practice. I just can't believe that things got that to that point. I can't believe people allowed that to happen. It's really sad. Anyway, James, why don't you wrap up new business?
I'm still going through Ace Attorney Investigations 2, very near the end of that. Stupidly long cases. And of course, I'm playing Wind Waker HD, but fuck how many times we've talked about Wind Waker on this show. It's not really relevant to get back into it. So I was in sort of Guillaume's boat of, I need something to talk about on the show, especially because we're on a Wednesday, and usually Wednesday night's the night where I go, fuck, I gotta find something to talk about. So I went to the eShop and just said, you know what, I've got a bunch of eShop, you know, digital deluxe points. Fuck it, let's just do something. And I ended up with Bases Loaded by Jellico, NES Virtual Console on 3DS, because I like baseball, and I like baseball from the NES era, and I thought, well, this can't be terrible.
So naive,
and,
James.
No, actually it can. It can be terrible. It's entirely plausible that this could be, and in fact is, terrible. So, if you're not familiar with Bases Loaded, but you do recall playing an NES baseball game. You're probably thinking of the games that were called in the RBI series that were published by Tengen, some of which were official NES games and some of which were not. They were all published in the US by Tengen, but they're actually developed by the company that made the Kunio-kun games, and I'm blanking on the name at the moment.
Oh, that's Konami.
Was it Technos?
Oh, Technos. No, yeah, Technos. Kunio-kun. Yeah. I was thinking of the Power Puro. That's Konami.
So Technos made the RBI baseball, so they were called something different in Japan, and then they were localized and released. I think they were called, like, Family Fun Baseball or something like that.
Or was it Famista? Power Pro Baseball?
Was it Family Stadium, Famista?
Yeah, it's for the Famista games. There's, like, 8 of them on the NES. I think we got, like, 4 of them. This isn't that game, because those games are you know, they're very much of the Technos art style. You know, they're super deformed, they're a little bit goofy, they're kind of ridiculous in some ways, but they play reasonably well. This game tries to do the opposite of all of that. So the character models are weirdly detailed. Like, they look like people, like, you know, normally portioned bodies. This game is developed by Tosei, although it was published by Jellico in the U.S. And basically it's 2 frames of animation for swinging and pitching. Very limited pitch control in that you press a button to pitch, and then you use the D-pad to kind of move the ball mid-flight. And swinging, you kind of have to press the ball a bunch of times to go through a full swing, or maybe it's you hold it down and release it at the right time. I'm not sure. I just kind of fumble through every time I'm at bat. I just kind of hammer the A button until the ball goes. Base running, I haven't figured out, even though I've played 3 games at this point, so I'm pretty much stuck at first every time. And fielding is an absolute shitfest where your characters run through fields of molasses. This is bases-loaded baseball, which is funny because I find it impossible to get the bases loaded, so that's okay. All of my runs were scored on home runs because there's no way I could run all 4 bases. It's great. What I found was interesting was that it has you pick a team just based on letters, which is pretty common from baseball games, and that actually continues through the Super Nintendo era, where it's just like, here's a letter, figure out what city we were kind of trying to intimate this is, but we can't say it because we don't have the license. And I picked Y, or J, because I was like, who the fuck is J? It's Jersey, apparently. The Jersey professional baseball team. And found that none of their – then you pick a pitcher and found that none of their pitchers have an ERA above 3.1, which isn't very good. And I thought, oh shit, this game is telling me something right off the bat. These pitchers are terrible. I had a guy who had a 5.8 ERA as a starting pitcher. That means per 9 innings, he gives up 5.8 runs. That's real bad. Well,
yes. That means he probably loses every game.
Yeah. Oh, no. He loses every game. Like
real bad.
his goal is to get a no decision. That's what he's going for in life.
And, I tell you, man, it's really a shame that this game isn't any better than it is, because Bases Loaded is a fantastic title for a baseball video game.
Oh, it's great! It's awesome!
It sounds like it must be great when you hear that title.
Yeah! Yep. And, like, they've got a dude with, like, a big 80s baseball player stash on it, and, like, it's kind of like... Like, it lacks some detail, but you can see the baseball. He's got the baseball cap. He's got the big stash. Like, yeah, this motherfucker's going to go out there and pitch. He probably chugs, like, a whole Miller Lite six-pack after every game and goes back out to the, you know, the pitcher's warm-up area and just chews an entire bag of chaw after every inning. Like, this guy is 80s fucking baseball. And then you play the game and you're like, no, this isn't what I wanted. This is something else entirely that's wrong. This is a bad thing. What's weird is I've kind of figured out fielding. Like, I figured that out somewhere in the 8th inning of my second game when I was down by 5. But what's amazing is, even though I hadn't really figured out fielding, the AI hadn't really figured out fielding either. So I was having a lot of fun with that. But it's rough. This is a rough fucking game.
So can you edit teams or anything like that?
Not that I've seen. But you do get surprisingly capable voiceover work. Like just like, it's home run. Like, it sounds like reasonably high fidelity.
That's impressive for an NES game.
There's moments that I've enjoyed so far where you can see the English text kind of snake in where the Japanese text was before. Where it kind of gets distorted, so it's like, this is really fucking weird game.
Yeah.
I don't understand this game at all.
Now, can you play like a tournament? Because seasons for this era are out of the question, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, 144 games of this is really just what I wake up for every
punishment?
Day. It's like every day I wake up and go, I need to get 14
games. For the love
out
of the game, James.
Yeah,
it's
I mean, I love the game,
buddy.
I love the fucking game. Don't start with me. This particular rendition of the game, I have some issues with. So I played my first game, and I picked my team, and I went in and I played. And I pick your team. I said, single player, pick my team, pick my pitcher, game starts. I've got a dude on my roster named Paste. That was cool. Run through 9 innings, and then I'm dumped back to the pick your pitcher menu. And I think, oh, no. This thing just keeps going. This goes on forever. And I'm playing the same team I played before, so I assume this is a series. And one thing I was surprised to note was that my pitcher got worse. Like his ERA went up, which seems impossible when his ERA was already 3.4, but it went up. The game has a password save system.
How many runs did he allow in the previous game?
He allowed 5.
That's why his ERA went up.
Yep. But I didn't expect this game to actually
implement
that.
So it has
that.
Password save.
Yeah, well, it also, yeah, it's got password saving, which is great. But I can't figure out for the life of me where to get the password from, so I don't know what's going on with this game at all. It does have multiplayer support, which I'm curious how that works, and download play, which is bizarre, and I don't know how you'd find someone to download play this with you. It's real bad. It's real.
Somewhere in America, there is someone who is like, you're dead, James. But yeah, not after, not until I play a game of Bases Loaded with you.
What's bizarre, and I say this relatively tongue-in-cheek, is that there are 4 Bases Loaded games. They made 4. Tosei managed to make 4 of these. And this is the one we got. Now, presumably that's because Jellico only published 1 of them. But holy shit. Why? Like, so, if you don't know...
Maybe the later ones are, like, much better. Maybe,
I think
is
they
this
are.
The first one?
I think they are pretty good, actually. I think by the time Bases Loaded 4 comes around, I think they're actually fairly competent. But this one is just generally known as being awful.
The thing I don't put out as interesting is that the reason this game's out is because Jellico actually still exists. Kind of. So, the video game company turned into a holding company at some point. Which is always a good sign for your business when you straight up convert to a holding company for your licenses. They then split the video game part out and sold that to another holding company. Yep. Who then got out of the video game business and created a spin-off holding company that just manages, it's called like Jellico Holdings. So the only reason we're able to buy this is because somewhere on a piece of paper, this company still exists.
Mm. Great. Mm. Nice.
Great. This is,
it lets them keep putting out Bases Loaded and other
gems. It lets them
gems.
Keep releasing this fucking game and womp them.
Yeah, it's this in like City Connection.
Yeah!
Yeah.
All right, well, James, you don't have to keep stretching for time because we're out of it for this segment. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking about summer gaming and maybe get a little bit of email.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
All right, first up we have a review of The History of Mario book by Justin Berube.
Book.
It's a book.
For the Nintendo Book System.
Yep, it is. It's for the Nintendo Book System, as James said. Want to know more about Mario than probably 95% of the planet? Problem solved. The next time you go to Nintendo Trivia at the local pub, you're really going to whip some ass if you study this tome. We also
Alternatively, you could just whip some ass with this tome.
You really could. You really could. I mean, you'd be the baddest guy. I mean, I don't know.
Violence is the answer
Violence
to
is
all
always
pub
the
trivia.
Answer. You're right, James. All right, and we have a review of Air Race Xeno for 3DS by Addison Webb. Do you feel the need for speed? Well, Air Race Xeno definitely has it for you, but what else is there? A true speed freak would reply in a gravelly voice, nothing. But Addison tells you whether or not there's enough game to go around in this case.
Nothing.
This week we also have a feature, 10 Ways to Boost Wii U Sales by Zach Miller.
Oh, no.
Zach presents an extremely serious look at what he thinks could save the Wii U's bacon. What? Are you kidding? This is Zach. Anime boobs and anime boobs are 3, 2, and 1. Okay, that's a lie. But get ready for some humor. And last this week, we have a review, Strike Force Fox on 3DS by Neil Ronahan. Ever play Choplifter? No? Congratulations! You're at least 10 years younger than John. Anyway, if you're looking for some arcade action, and who isn't? Jesus. This helicopter saga may be right up your alley. Read Neil's review to find out. Jesus.
That's it.
Yep, that's it. For all the other stuff that we do on this website, because we do some stuff like news and reviews and previews and debuts and all that kind of things, you can go check it out at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Welcome back, everyone. You know, it's about a month into the summer here in the Northern Hemisphere, and I thought it's been very hot in my neck of the woods lately, and I thought, you know, it'd be interesting to talk about summer gaming as a thing, as a concept, and is it really different than just general gaming? Do we play differently in the summertime? Do we crave different kinds of games? So I thought, well, this might be kind of a fun little like mini feature to do, just because we've had several weeks now of listener mail, and I love doing that. I always want to get in more emails, but sometimes I like to break it up a little bit. So summer gaming, I don't know if you guys ever really think of it in those terms, but for me, I think it goes back to growing up as a child. You know, being in school, you don't always have time to do all the gaming that you want. And for me in the summertime a lot, it was a chance to really like stretch out and play the games that take much longer to play through. So I think in the summer, I usually look forward to playing a lot of RPGs, getting things that, you know, I could really spend a lot of time on because I had all the time in the world. In the summer, I didn't go to camp or anything like that most years. So I had a lot of time at home to kind of do whatever I wanted. And I grew up in the South where it's friggin' hot in the summer and you don't want to go outside.
It's fucking miserable.
It's like real, real nasty, 95 to 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
It's 85 degrees outside right now at 10:30 at night.
Yeah.
That's fucked
up. So like, that's partly why I was an indoors kid growing up. Well, it's partly why I got so into video games because I didn't want to go outside when it was that hot. So I associate the summertime with playing a lot of video games, at least spending a lot of time with video games. What about you guys?
Well, let's see. For me, it was kind of the same thing. I would play RPGs during the summer, but also I'd play, because all the other kids are out of school, it gives you a chance to kind of coordinate stuff. So what we used to do is we would have sports leagues going on. So we would play stuff like Tecmo Bowl, NHL hockey.
Not
we'd
actual be able to, sports.
No, not actual sports. You crazy? Yeah. So we'd be able to do that over several weeks or months. We would, you know, take the cartridge over to somebody else's house and play through their games, and then go to somebody else's house and play through their games. So it was good. It was fun. You could do that on weekends too. Everybody sits around and just plays for the whole day and passes off the controller. It's good times.
Yeah, that's awesome. I do think it is also for the same reason. It's a great chance to get together and play a little bit of multiplayer. And I wasn't doing that all day every day, but I probably have more memories of getting people together to play, you know, GoldenEye or even earlier stuff, NES games, just kind of crowding around and checking things out. Probably happened more in the summertime. Mm-hmm. Than it did the rest of the year because of that, because we were all out of school. We were able to get together sometimes.
I don't know. I recall playing a lot of RPGs, sure, but I wonder if it's not just because I played a lot of RPGs overall, like on the Super Nintendo. I remember, well, first, like my Super Nintendo was in the basement. So it was just the coolest place in the whole house. So I can imagine. Yeah, I can very easily imagine myself just staying down there instead of going into the sun and playing and whatever kids are supposed to do during the summer. I also have like these memories of going to a friend's house and his room was in the freaking attic. And I remember playing Super Mario RPG and was just sweltering. And like, how can you live in this environment? How can your room be this hot? I can't. It's insane. I can't even play a video game. I wouldn't be able to do anything in here. So yeah, I just
good times, good memories.
Yeah, I don't know, like just RPGs, longer games, and it's probably the same today because it just happened, you know. Like I didn't plan on spending the summer playing Xenoblade, but that sure seems to be what my summer is shaping up to be.
Sure. James, any particular trends that you've ever noticed with your summer gaming habits?
No, because so I've talked about it on the show before. I had an NES for a long time. I didn't get the Super Nintendo until the Super Nintendo was more or less dead and the N64 was out. I actually got the Super Nintendo after the N64 was a hand-me-down. So I played Super Nintendo with friends. I had my NES collection of just garbage and just abysmal fucking garbage that I had in my NES collection. We've talked about multiple times on the show. But mostly I was playing PC games, and I didn't really change what I played. I played what I wanted to play, which was a lot of flight sims, a lot of strategy games, a lot of, you know, like simulation games, just stuff that is very much in the purview of the PC gaming space. It wasn't so when I have an N64, when I've started to move on, like the GameCube especially, the GameCube was really when I was actually on top of games that were coming out at that moment. I played whatever I wanted to play whenever I wanted to play it. I mean, I'd play an RPG when I was in school. I would just break it up into, like, I have a couple hours before I have to go to bed, I'll play that, and then tomorrow I'll play a couple more hours, and then on the weekend I'll fucking marathon the shit out of this game. But yeah, I mean, I basically just played a lot of whatever because it's 70-90% humidity every day and never less than like 92. It's horrible. It's breathing water right now. It's goddamn awful. So
yeah, it's like heavy snow. It's, you don't want to go anywhere in it.
Yeah, right? It really is.
It's the other extreme.
It is this horrible experience of, I just don't want to be outside. I don't care what I'm doing. Just anything that's not outside. So in terms of what games I played, it didn't really matter. How I consumed them might change. So I played through Eternal Darkness, for example, on July 4th weekend, or like the couple days between just like that Monday and that weekend. And I remember just marathoning it every night, which is exactly the wrong way to play that game. Like 3 a.m. in the dark, alone playing that game is really, really the absolute best.
Sounds ideal.
Best way to play it, especially to do that like 4 nights in a row. And I seem to recall being sick during it. So it's just a good combination of really, just a really bad situation all around and just feeling really angry at the game a lot. But it was just, I got to play more hours. When I was in high school, because I had to get up so early for school, you know, I didn't really get to play that much in the evening.
The whole like feeling sick thing, I can definitely associate with playing some games in the summer, like after moving out of the basement. And like in when I was in college in dorms, I have memories of picking up a GameCube that summer that Eternal Darkness came out, and I rented Pikmin, and I just remember getting huge headaches from the combination of the extreme heat in the dorms and the effect when it's kind of blurry, a blur of movement, you know, like the camera, the graphics in Pikmin had this kind of, I don't know if it was out of necessity or if it was an effect that they added, but there seemed to be a trail as if like the screen didn't refresh fast enough.
Yeah, blur.
And I wonder
if that was the TV you had in your dorm room.
It was a CRT, so I don't think so. But yeah, I remember not having a good time playing the first Pikmin, probably entirely because it was the summer, it was hot, and it was uncomfortable. And same thing with Rogue Squadron. Not good memories of Rogue Leader. I'm sorry, whatever, the GameCube one, the first one.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I just, it was, it demanded too much concentration trying to see, to distinguish the TIE fighters from the black background. And
that's the most challenging thing in that game.
Yeah. I mean,
in any condition you play it in, unless you like drive the contrast to really weird levels on your TV. I mean, it's supposed to be. That's why the TIE fighters are designed the way they are, is because they're supposed to be hard to see.
Right.
But holy crap, in Rogue Leader, they're really hard to see against most of the backgrounds that you fight them on. Unless you use that targeting computer, and that's exactly why they put it in there. You know, they punish you a little bit in the scoring mechanics, I guess.
Yep.
But
yep.
You can flip that thing on real quick and just be like, oh, yeah, they're over there. And then you can go after them without it.
So, yeah, just, I don't know, summer gaming when you don't have a good environment for it is just miserable. Might as well just go outside or do something crazy like
well,
God,
so you
know?
You probably grew up without – did you grow up with air conditioning?
No.
Yeah. See,
but
that's...
also, like, in dorms, yeah. like, forget about it. They wouldn't give us the
storage. Oh, dorms are just... like our dorms, except for the really old ones, have AC because people would die if they didn't.
Yeah, I mean, really, like you keep.
I mean, literally, they would die. It's bad.
Yeah, it's.
Yeah, my dorms had AC, but it wasn't very good. No. I mean, the rooms just weren't designed very well. They weren't insulated very well.
Right. I mean, they
so the
emptied
hallways
out.
And the common areas would always be a lot cooler than the rooms.
The one dorm that doesn't have AC, they will not use it during the summer because people will. Fucking die. I mean, it's bad. it's like a hundred. Yep. It's so, like 100 in December. I mean, it's terrible. So it's going to be horrible in the summer.
So James, you mentioned that you know at the time when you were younger, you weren't following new releases necessarily until much later,
right?
But I wanted to get into that a little bit because you know I don't think you have to be like up on the latest releases all the time to notice that for 3 or 4 months out of the year, there usually wasn't much coming out. You know, in the summertime, video games just, it seemed like we had the most time to play them and there was the least like new stuff that people were talking about or that was being marketed to you. There just, it wasn't a time when you release a lot of video games. And so I think especially when I was a teenager and I was playing a lot of Super Nintendo and N64 stuff, the summer became a lot of times for me, a chance to replay games that I'd already played before, especially RPGs, you know, because I had such giant chunks of time that I could devote to this stuff. So I think that there was probably a couple summers there in the mid 90s that, you know, I got really into like replaying Chrono Trigger and Final Fantasy III several times all the way through. And it just became like something to do. You know, it was almost just killing time or just marking time through the summer. I mean, I loved it. And I would always try to play it differently. I'd always try different things every time I went through it. But it's hard for me to fathom that nowadays. Of course, I don't get summers off anymore, so it's a little bit different situation. But that was definitely part of it. And I don't know, nowadays as an adult, I'm not sure that my summer gaming habits are really that much different, except that if anything, I might play less now because I live in a place, and this is partly because of the weather during the summer months, but now I live in a place that's much more tolerable to be outside most of the time. And so if I'm at home and I actually have free time and the sun is out, a lot of times I'll try to go outside just because I want to soak it up. You know, at my job, I don't get a whole lot of sunlight. So I like to go outside and do something physical while I can because it's usually just for like an hour or two after I get off work before the sun goes down. So, you know, if I'm home early enough to get some sunlight, I try to get some of that. And so in the summertime, I feel like I probably play less stuff. Whereas in the wintertime, it may be dark by the time I get home. So, you know, I'm just going to turn on a game immediately and just play it until bedtime. That happens a lot in the wintertime. In the summer, not so much. So if anything, I play games less in the summer nowadays. But the releases also have become more consistent in the summer because you have stuff like all the indie games and the download, you know, the smaller download games that come out really all year round. And so there may not be as many big AAA games, but I don't often play those when they're brand new anyway. Maybe a couple every fall, but I'm not going out playing, you know, buying the newest Madden or racing game or first person shooter all the time. But you know, sometimes I do catch up on those games during the summertime. But more likely, I'm playing a lot of smaller stuff, and that certainly has been the case the past few years. So for me, I look forward to summer in the sense that there's not as much pressure to be playing the newest thing because a lot of times there isn't the newest thing. There's just there's nothing out that's really like of note. And so it feels more like a free-for-all where I can go play weird stuff that I might normally not have time for, or I go back and play something that seemed interesting that I just didn't have time for earlier when it was first released. So I look forward to summer a lot to catch up, even though it's probably the time of year when I have the least gaming time as an adult.
See, as an adult, I live in a place where summer is intolerable and winter isn't much better. Because, I mean, it's below freezing pretty much every day of the winter. And it's goddamn awful all summer. So, like, we had a couple days last week after a massive thunderstorm came through where it was, like, in the high 70s, low 80s, and I was outside a lot. But during the summer and winter, I basically can't go outside. So it's just a lot of long gaming sessions. So, I mean, a great example of just a real awful day when I was on my I had that 2 weeks off last December, and I played a whole shitload of Persona 3 because it was like 18 degrees Fahrenheit, no matter how many layers you have on, with really nasty wind, not a lot of fun.
Nope.
the funny thing is, there's probably a lot of people listening to this who are like, that's not that bad for wintertime. I mean, 18 is cold, but it's certainly, around here, it's not enough to keep you from going outside.
It's that wind that's miserable.
Well, in Virginia, it's the humidity also is really nasty in the cold weather. Like, if it's below freezing, then humid air feels terrible.
Oh, it's freaking awful. And you sit there and you just suffer for it. And then you go inside where it's super dry because you're heat. So when you go back outside, you're even less ready for it. Yeah, it's bad. It's bad all around. So, like, I would just play, you know, I had days of that break where I sat down, you know, I got up around 10, went and had, like, a late breakfast, maybe went out and did Christmas shopping, and then came back in around 2, sat down with lunch, and then played Persona 3 and looked up, and it was late. And I don't mean, like, it's dark, because that would be, like, 6. I mean, it's late. It's like, oh, shit, that's the Paperboy. And
all right, well, that's winter gaming.
Yeah, well, but the same thing is summer. Summer is the same experience for me when I can. But mostly it's just I'll sit down and just kind of turn it off and just go for a while. And then when I'm done, I'm done.
I just, I don't know. Nowadays, I think that perhaps my 3DS playing time is drastically reduced, which might be counterintuitive because you would think, well, it's summer, you want to walk around, you want to, you know, have your portable maybe more than stay at home and play a Wii U. But it's just that I bike to work instead of taking public transport.
Oh, you can play while you bike. What's your problem?
It's not recommended. Well, none of the streets of Montreal where it's full of potholes and people wouldn't like it. I don't really carry it around as much. I don't get as many street passes because, you know, there's a bunch of universities here, but all the students are home, so you don't get as many street passes. And, it's just there's less reason to carry the 3DS around.
I would say the other narrative there is that there are Nintendo's pushing the 3DS somewhat less than the Wii U at the moment.
Sure, but I don't know. Like, usually...
No, they're definitely pushing it less than they had been.
No, that's true. Sure. But, I mean, there were two kind of big-ish releases in May 3, actually. Like, Tomodachi Life, that was in June. There was Mario Golf. There was Kirby.
Yeah, but none of those are, like, long sit-down-and-play games. I mean, would you long sit down and play Tomodachi Life for like 4 hours? Your answer should be no if it's something else.
60 or 70, maybe?
I've seen it happen.
Oh, man.
Oh, my gosh. You're special, Guillaume. yeah, no, James is right. I mean, it would be nice if there had been kind of like a big, big, long, you know, RPG release for 3DS this summer. That was not the case, but... You know, Alice has had a lot of deals, so I guess if you're looking for a summer game, Alice has had all kinds of 3DS eShop deals where you can get Shin Megami Tensei 4 or one of the other ones they've got out, the Etrian Odyssey series, certainly. But, you know, there's always stuff like that. I mean, I'm never really lacking for games to choose from, so that it's not so much that. It's more like the kinds of games I feel like playing, I guess, and the ones that I have the time for.
Right.
So anyway, any final thoughts on summer gaming before we wrap this up and move on to some email?
I don't know. The seasons don't influence my gaming habits as much as editing this freaking podcast does. That's an actual you know, life change, you know, like it does eat away at my time a lot. And I make, you know, rash decisions like getting Mr. Driller 2 just so I have something to talk about. And also I know, oh, it's short, so I'm not committing to anything really big and that I won't have time to play. The seasons pass and you can play old games, new games anytime. Like you can play any game year round. So who cares?
Yeah, I mean, full-time employment really hampers my summer gaming. So, you know, what are you going to do?
Can't complain, right, bro?
Yeah.
All right, well, that'll wrap up our little bit of mini feature. But if you have any thoughts on summer gaming, I bet some of you have some good stories or some good thoughts on the subject. You can send those to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And you can actually email us about pretty much any topic, such as the ones we've got picked out for the rest of this episode. So let's see. Let's start off with this email from Mr. Adolf Vega. And he writes, longtime listener, by the way, he writes, is it time to start thinking about the 3DS successor? 2013 was a landmark year for 3DS, but lately Nintendo handhelds don't have a long life. 3 years between GBA and DS, 5 years between DS and DSi, and 3 years between DSi and 3DS. So do we need a real successor to 3DS, a redesign like XL, Micro, 2DS, or just a minimal upgrade like DSi? What does the upgrade need? Multi-touch screen, dual circle pad, high resolution screens, more RAM, faster, more powerful processors, lose the clamshell design, or does this really matter? How can Nintendo make a 3DS successor that really competes with smartphones without segmenting the market further and avoiding consumer confusion and be profitable and gain third-party support? Sort of seems like 3DS might be the last Nintendo portable system to me.
I think it'll be the last Nintendo portable that's on its own and completely divorced from the consoles. Because you know, we've seen Iwata talk about, you know, having the same kind of OS platform across multiple devices. So I think the next console and the next handheld are going to be more closely entwined than previously.
So. Yeah, I mean, that's a popular theory. I'm not going to dispute it, but
Iwata's basically said it. I mean, he's talked about that they're doing that.
No, not in a hardware sense, I don't think. I mean, he's talked about uniting their software development teams, but that's partly, you know, having common development architectures. That's not the same thing as saying, you know, the next versions of these will effectively be the same thing, or they'll.
No, I'm not saying that either. I'm not saying they're going to have the same hardware, but they're going to be very architecturally similar in terms of what OS they're running.
Okay, so
that's for sure.
So are you thinking something like an iPhone versus an iPad? Like two different devices with, you know, somewhat different use cases, but they effectively run the same operating system and, you know, they have a lot of the same shared applications you can run.
Yeah, sort of. Something similar like that. Probably, I mean,
I could kind of see them going that way, because I got to say one thing that I'd like in the next handheld from Nintendo, and I'm sure there will be a next handheld regardless. You know, I think the big question is like, how different is it than 3DS? Is it fully compatible? Is it just a tiny upgrade, or is it a new platform, maybe with backwards compatibility? I think actually they've done backwards compatibility. They've done backwards compatibility for a really long time. There's not a massive library of 3DS software to be carried forward to the next generation. And they do seem to be hitting some kind of saturation level with 3DS. I mean, maybe they'll come up with some breakthrough game idea that will cause it to have a resurgence. We've seen that in the past, and it's certainly possible again. But I feel like 3DS is probably trending downward. You know, when you look at the NPD sales, it's selling like, you know, maybe 3/4, maybe half of what it did a year earlier. And it'll certainly have a very good Christmas this year, but I don't know if it has another big Christmas in it. And I have to imagine Nintendo's getting pretty serious about, you know, planning for the next stage, whatever that may be, whether it's some attempt to refresh the 3DS and make it feel new again, or really do something that's new and different. I'd kind of like to see them go in a smaller direction. You know, I mean, I like the XL, but it's not very portable. And I think when you look at, you know, if they're competing with things like smartphones, you know, smartphones fit in your pocket. The 3DS really doesn't. Even the original 3DS is kind of bulky. Yeah. So for me, you know, like I think the dual screen concept has worked out great for them and they've done a lot with it. But when you look at the 3DS, the new 3DS games, most of them don't use that touchscreen and they don't use the fact that it has two screens very well at all. It just seems to be a really minor feature nowadays. And, you know, they don't have to kill off the 3DS right away. So if there's stuff in process, if there's still more, you know, designed to be mined out of these concepts, you know, and they leave that platform available for people, especially like indie developers who want to keep making their small download games. But I feel like Nintendo could go in a simpler direction that goes back to one screen. It allows them to keep down development costs, which seems to be a big problem with the third-party developers and the Western developers. You know, I mean, it costs a fair bit of money to make a 3DS game. I mean, it's a very advanced platform. It's very significantly more expensive than it was on the DS. And that seems to be limiting the number of releases it gets. So I could see them going in the opposite direction, not saying the new system would be less powerful than 3DS, but maybe you don't have to worry about a 3D screen. You don't have to worry about programming two screens. You don't have to worry about all the weird development kit stuff that goes with having such an unusual system. Maybe they streamline it. They make it a little bit more traditional, and they make the unit more portable, you know, more like an old game, an old fashioned Game Boy, just modern and sophisticated, and make it. I think that could be more appealing to developers, maybe.
What do you guys think? It would be hard to make it less appealing to developers. I don't know what's going on, but it looks like every big publisher got rid of their handheld teams. Everyone is doubling down on mobile, and even amongst indie developers, it seems like only the already Nintendo faithful, like the people that have been working on you know, DS games and maybe even like GBA games and who have had some success there, only them seem to be aware that there's a possibility to make money on Nintendo handhelds. And Nintendo really hasn't been very effective in kind of mending bridges and, you know, like there's a lot of convincing they have to do after Iwata basically said that garage developers were kind of, you know, did not have their place on Nintendo systems.
I think a lot of it just has to do with part of the problem with third-party development and even indie development on 3DS is that Unity doesn't work on 3DS. For whatever reason, I've heard all kinds of theories. It should. They really need to fix that because it's used by so many independent and small development studios. And I know a lot of people want to put their games on 3DS, but it's hard to do. The development tools really aren't that mature for it, especially on a small scale. And, you know, the web framework stuff, for instance, that they're doing for Wii U games, that kind of thing is not available on 3DS. So I don't know if it's something that can be fixed on this current platform, but definitely on the next handheld, whatever it may be, they've got to make it a lot easier to develop for, not only for large companies, but for small companies too.
And maybe they should think about, I don't know, maybe like using more engines from the West, actually, you know, like more, just make it easier for Western developers, because from what we know, how it works, like the support, like if the developers have questions, the questions have to be translated both ways. Like the questions and answers have to be translated. And it's just not, you know, it's just not very effective, especially in the early days of a platform. Developers have questions and they don't get answers until weeks later.
Yeah. Support-wise, they aren't very good with English support. Or North American.
No,
support.
It seems like it. That's what we keep hearing.
Yeah.
So yeah, they've got a lot of development environment issues to deal with. You know, and it seems to be worse actually on the handheld than it is for the console division, especially this generation.
Yeah.
James, what do you think about all this? 3DS successor.
I think based on the tone of the conversation I'm hearing, I think you all are way underestimating how far away it is. Because
really?
Yeah, because think of it this way. they'd have to relaunch a system, rebuild a consumer base. Because right now they have a fairly sizable consumer base. That system is also still selling fucking unbelievably in Japan. The top eight games sold in Japan this year, I believe seven of them are 3DS games.
But Japan's also in a huge rut, so I mean it may be relatively dominant, but it's dominating a very weak market.
No one's buying consoles in Japan; they're all buying handhelds,
and that's fine because that means they're making money on it.
I'm sure they are. For them right now, it could probably be doing even better than it is. How? Is what I'm saying, because the market is so weak overall in Japan.
To sell 10 out of the top 10 games, I mean.
It's more about how many units. I mean, the 3DS their handheld hardware is a huge moneymaker for Nintendo. So if they're not selling the number of units that they want to be, will release a new hardware.
Software still makes more money than hardware does, especially somebody else's software, because you didn't spend a dime making it. That is what true profit is. So it seems like cutting your install base out right now when there's not necessarily a super strong reason to, because I think seeing the sales tail off from the release of the XL is natural. It's been out, 2 years now?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could squeeze another hardware revision out, but I don't think releasing a new system in the next 2 years is probably the smartest decision they could make. If I would say that it's got, at the very least, this Christmas and next Christmas unrivaled by another Nintendo console, a Nintendo handheld, because right now, yes, there are not a lot of games from Western major developers coming out. There are none. But what's to say that releasing a new system is going to fix that? What's coming out on Vita from these companies that actually people want to play?
Vita's even worse. I mean, a lot of the things that we've talked about with 3DS and the reasons that there isn't much development support, all that stuff is even worse on Vita.
That's not true, though. It's fairly easy to get a PS3 game running on Vita.
Yet that's if you make PS3 games. I mean, a lot of companies don't do that either. But my point is that even if it is easier to make Vita games, I think it's still too hard for a lot of people. But even if it is relatively easy to make a game for Vita, why would you? The install base is atrocious, you know. So there's a lot of companies that don't want to release games on Vita, not because it's so expensive, although it is expensive to do like a big production game on Vita. But like nobody's going to buy it. You know, like there aren't enough units out there to make it worthwhile. So 3DS doesn't have that problem. I think a lot of it on 3DS is its perception. Part of it's the perception that nobody wants to buy third-party games on the system. And I don't know if that's true, but if that is true, then that could probably be changed. You know, I think Nintendo probably should get involved in changing that. And frankly, the caliber of games that third parties have made on 3DS isn't very high.
Well, and releasing a new platform.
It's pathetic compared to the stuff Nintendo's done for
releasing
it,
a new platform.
Well,
is it
every Nintendo system ever, I swear to God.
No, like, that's not.
That's all
that's
you ever hear,
true.
Man. It's the same. It was the same with the Wii. I mean, it's always like that, though, with Nintendo. But Nintendo never does anything to change it. Third parties have always screwed over Nintendo consoles and systems and handhelds. I mean, outside of the DS. The DS, that was.
Well, even then, go look at your DS library. How many games from Western publishers do you have? Not that many.
Truly Western.
Not that many Western, but at least there were some great Japanese third-party games on DS. And on 3DS, I don't even think that's true.
I disagree. There are solid 3DS published games, 3DS Japanese developed, non-Nintendo developed games made in Japan. Unfortunately, Nintendo's having to do the burden of publishing them in the West in many cases, which is truly unfortunate.
Even the Japanese publishers don't want to release 3DS games over here.
And I don't know how releasing a new handheld system and saying, hey, we're going to start over with a new install base is really going to engender that kind of confidence in the publishers. I just don't see what they'd look at and go, oh, good, a system with even less of an install base. It's still a Nintendo system. We're still going to have to deal with the impression that only Nintendo games sell on Nintendo systems. It doesn't help you solve that problem, releasing new hardware.
That's a fair point.
All that does is say, I'm going to reset back to zero. And
the main reason I think that a new 3DS or whatever follows 3DS is coming within the next couple of years is that the hardware sales are just – they're trending downwards so steeply. And they never reached the peaks of DS or even GBA in the first place. So I think we've seen it time and time again when the hardware falls off for their handhelds, Nintendo will do something. They will release a new revision or they will move on to the next thing.
And I think they've still got ground to move on a revision at this point. They could.
They may. What would that be, James?
So something like less chunky.
Yeah, yeah. Something
either one of the form factors.
Something that is more portable in and of itself. I mean, something that you can move without having, because a 2DS isn't really a full 3DS, because it's certainly not as portable because it's a fucking slate.
It's relatively large and it has pretty small screens.
The XL is big and it looks nice, but it's big. And then the original unit, which you can still get, it's just not a very good unit.
No, it's not really.
Where their room to maneuver is probably kill the original 3DS, drop the price of the other two slightly, and then release a new premium 3DS about the same form factor, but maybe let more of the actual space be devoted to screens, because there is wasted space on both the top and the bottom of that system, and just make the whole thing nicer to use. Get rid of the Oreo cookie look that's going on in there, make it nice and smooth, and just make it look like a nice piece of equipment. It doesn't have to be as big as the current one does. The battery technology they have now alone is better than they had when that system came out. That will buy you some space by itself. I mean, there's a lot of things they can do to make a better 3DS that is smaller, has better screen technology, can just have bigger screens, really, and just ultimately is a more sexy piece of equipment that you may want to carry with you. There's room to maneuver there.
I bet they could do something that has about the same screen size as the XL, but put it on the original shell. Yeah. You know, something that's about the size of the original 3DS. I bet that's possible.
The only thing you'd have to do is move the speakers.
Everything on there needs to get a lot thinner.
Yeah, and I'm sure it can.
That's the main problem with carrying around a 3DS, and that goes for both models. Both of the clamshell models, it's just way too thick just not very popular.
Oh, absolutely.
You
know?
And for its size, it's very heavy. Well, especially the original one.
It's super dense. The original one is super fucking dense.
Yep.
I mean, maybe if it gets to the point where all 3DS retail software is released digitally, then maybe they could go PSP Go on it, although I'm not sure that's a great idea.
They're already there.
Is every single retail game, Nintendo and not, released on the eShop?
Every Nintendo game is, and I think pretty much every third-party game is, of which there are so few that who cares?
So they could very easily say, okay, we're going to just
leave out the cartridge slot altogether. Of course, you'd lose DS backwards compatibility.
But they've done that before.
But I think it's been long enough. That's probably acceptable.
And then you could lose that, and then they could also roll back around and sell you .nds files on the eShop.
Fuck yes.
By the way, all that's on a DS cartridge is a .nds file, and the 3DS plays those natively.
Mm-hmm.
Just download it. That's it. You're done.
Please.
This is PSP Go 2.0, but not shitty.
3DS Micro?
Go.
The 3DS Micro? No, I don't think that name's got enough going for it. But something with a snappier name that says, look, we're getting rid of the cartridge slot. We're saving some money there. So they get to pocket a little bit more cash. This is a nicer unit, so we can charge a little bit more for it. We're going to drop the price of all the existing units down just a little bit to get their sales moving. And then we have this new unit that we can sell to people. And maybe they come up with some mechanism, say, hey, if you own the retail copy of these games.
Oh, I don't think they'll bother with that.
No. Hold on.
You can do a system transfer at least. I mean, you could all your digital stuff you could take with you.
I think they may even come up with something. Look, if you own the retail copies, you'll have to still buy these again. But we'll make it so you can get your save. Because they do have a utility to move a save from retail to digital.
You can already do that.
I think they may give some kind of bridge mechanism. We'll get your saves off your retail cards on your original 3DS and let you move them on over. Besides that,
I think you can already do that.
But you'd have to have the digital version of the game on the first 3DS first. Maybe they'd.
Oh, I see.
Give you some mechanism to get them off so you can get them onto the one. And then incentivize you to buy those games again. It was like, well, your saves are still here, so you're good to go. I mean.
Yeah, hey, I've got the perfect name for it. The 3DX.
Oh, God.
Isn't that? I mean. You know, DX has a lot of meaning to the Japanese market.
It does.
It sounds similar, but it also sounds newer and better and a little sharper, a little more sophisticated maybe than the 3DS. I think that name would work in on both sides of the globe.
I think that they need to get away from the DS naming scheme because people were already, you know, confused enough.
Well, this is a 3DS, though, so there's no reason to get away yet. On the next system, yeah, get away from it. But right now, this is a 3DS. Yeah. So there, you don't want to get away from it. You want people to know, no, this is a 3DS, but this is the best premium, 3DS.
Cool new version.
But they got away from it with a 2DS.
Well, they didn't. Not really.
No, the 2DS is so meta. The 2DS doesn't even make sense unless you know that 3DS is a thing.
Yeah, but I mean, if you know the 3DS is a thing and you see the 2DS, the joke, you almost get it instantly. This is a 3DS, doesn't do 3D. You assholes.
Yeah, we've spoken at length with admiration for the 2DS name, admiration of how crazy and bizarre it is.
Yeah, and just fucking.
Like, subversive almost.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I think they've got one more hardware revision in the system. And I think if they pull it right, this could be one that allows them to move the existing units of the hardware they've produced for the other models and then produce a more high-line 3DS that can. A, cut some corners on in terms of manufacturing costs, and B, maybe start to stage their digital only future. Maybe say, look, we've now got a system in the market that is digital only. We can prove to ourselves it works. We can experiment with marketing strategies for this kind of digital only system. We can figure out how we want to do this because their next two systems, they got to make a call. Do they want to have retail releases on these systems? And
yeah, and I think, you know, to me, because the Nintendo handhelds do traditionally sell really well, they've always been very strong. They've never gone through like a severe slump. I think they could probably get away with going all digital on the next system. I don't know that I'm not predicting that they will, because I think, you know, for young people, it's tricky. You know, like
there's also desire to maintain your relationship with retailers, which means you have to have them to sell your system.
But they're going to sell your system. And unlike something like a PSP or especially a Vita, Nintendo can tell retailers, look, people are going to go to your store to buy the system. They're also going to probably buy accessories and things like that.
Profit margin.
It's okay. They're probably not going in to buy 3DS retail games right now anyway, not that many. So,
but the profit margin on a retail game versus on a hardware, even for the end retailer, is much better than on the hardware.
Yeah, I know. But they've still got – they're selling eShop cards and, you know.
Maybe
they could get away with it. I don't know if they would try it, but
yeah,
it's probably reaching the
breakpoint
of possibility.
I feel like they would definitely want to experiment before they committed to doing it on a platform itself.
Yeah.
Sony has tried something that I'm sure Nintendo doesn't want to repeat, and it's the whole proprietary memory card thing.
Oh, and they never will. It's not their MO to make a proprietary memory card. I mean,
no, but I mean, Sony was very specifically targeting retailers, trying to assuage their fears.
Sony just likes to make fucking proprietary memory units. They've been doing that for decades.
Yeah, but a lot of that was, you know, to throw retailers a bone.
But James, if I understand your point, I think I agree with it, which would be that like a third revision of the 3DS hardware would be a good time to experiment
with
a digital-only system, because if it doesn't work out,
whatever.
They didn't ruin the 3DS and they haven't committed to that for the life of the platform with a brand new handheld.
And if you go look at the DSi, you see
the same beginning
experimentation for what the 3DS digital presence was going to be.
True. And yeah, that's a very good point, actually. I like that.
This is this gives them, let's say they give that thing a year and a half. Because they don't tend to release their a lot of their handhelds recently have come out like middle of the year, kind of maybe March, somewhere in that time frame. So let's say they give that new system a year and see how it's doing. And then they can kind of make a decision make a lot of decisions probably in the first 6 months, say, okay, this isn't working. Let's try to back off that. And we can focus more on this component of how I want the system to work. I mean, Microsoft rejiggered the entire business model of the Xbox One. Between when they announced it and when they released the damn thing. If they haven't announced
this stuff. Nintendo has a penchant for announcing handheld revisions very shortly before they put them on the market. Like sometimes less than 2 months. I tell you, in this case, it might be smart for them to do it in the West first, because the hardware sales are still, as you said, James, pretty brisk in Japan. So maybe they don't need the revision there. I think they kind of need it here. It's slowed down a ton.
Yeah, and
if they really want to push, you know, something like Smash Brothers on 3DS this year, it'd be pretty smart to release a hardware revision that's targeted at, you know, an older, you know, someone who has a little bit more money, who's not interested whatsoever in something like the 2DS. I think it would make a lot of sense to release your new revision in the West alongside a big game. You know, and Smash Brothers might be one of the last really huge game releases on that system. So if you're going to release a hardware revision, that'd be a good time to do it.
I'd guess we'd probably get at least a couple more big-ish games that come out.
Big-ish, but the rate has slowed down, and I think it will continue to. And, you know, I mean, the 3DS certainly will have a big presence in Christmas 2015. But is it going to have a huge, like, game release around that time? I'm not so sure. I think, you know, Codename Steam will have already been out for a while. I think that's coming out early next year.
I mean, if we're being honest, we're probably going to get another Mario game in that time frame.
Maybe. There'll definitely be a new Pokemon.
Yeah.
But, but nothing like really big and fresh and exciting. It'll be kind of the usual suspects, I think, in 2015. It'll be the kind of thing that happens in like the last hurrah. You know, like the last big successful holiday season for a platform. It'll be the kind of games you would expect to see.
We'll probably get about three or four more Kirby games in there.
Definitely.
All right. So it sounds like, you know, we're all looking forward to whatever it is. I mean, I could say, like, you know, I've had the XL for almost 2 years now, and I still like the system a lot, but there's enough things that have kind of piling up that I wish were better, that I'm totally ready for a revision. If that's what ends up happening, I'd pony up for it in a heartbeat. Thank you for writing in, Mr. Vega, and everybody else. We will get back to more emails next time, and the address, of course, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Before we go, I want to remind you that you can hear me as a guest on Player One Podcast, episode 402. It's a ton of fun. If you've never heard that show before, I think you will enjoy it quite a bit. So please go check that out over at p1podcast.com, I think, or player1podcast.com. Anyway, you can find it. It's on iTunes. It's super easy to find. And you can hear Guillaume with our friend TYP over on Radio Trivia Podcast Edition. We plugged it a little bit last week. I've heard the episode now. It's a really good one, and there's some fantastic, surprising music on there. There's one game I'm not going to spoil, but I'll say I was listening to the songs and I thought, this is amazing. I might go buy this just for the music, and then found out later I already own it. So <Yeah. laughs> I'm going to have to go play more of it, obviously. But it's a great episode. So definitely check that out as well.
Very good music, minimal talking. Just
just the kind of podcast Guillaume loves. Radio trivia.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's the opposite of my appearances on there. So anyway, that's it. Enjoy your summer gaming, and we'll hit you up next time here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Bye.
Farewell.